Without even telling Howard what she was up to, she telephoned Southwest General and asked about volunteer work. Ascertaining that nothing was required but a blameless character, a sound mind and strong legs, she had demanded an application form. Volunteer work had opened a whole new, glorious world to Shirley. This was the dream that Julia Fawley had inadvertently handed her beside the grand piano, that of herself, standing with her hands clasped demurely in front of her, her laminated pass around her neck, while the Queen moved slowly down a line of beaming helpers. She saw herself dropping a perfect curtsy. The Queen's attention caught, she stopped to chat. She congratulated Shirley on generously giving her free time, a flash and a photograph, and the newspapers the next day. "The Queen chats to hospital volunteer Mrs. Shirley Mollison." Sometimes, when Shirley really concentrated on this imaginary scene, an almost holy feeling came over her. Volunteering at the hospital had given Shirley a glittering new weapon with which to whittle down Maureen's pretensions. When Ken's widow had been transformed, Cinderella-like, from shop girl to business partner, she had taken on airs that Shirley, though enduring it all with a pussycat smile, found infuriating. But Shirley had retaken the higher ground. She worked, not for profit, but out of the goodness of her heart. It was classy to volunteer. It was what women did who had no need of extra cash. Women like herself and Julia Fawley. What was more, the hospital gave Shirley access to a vast mine of gossip to drown out Maureen's tedious prattling about the new cafe. This morning, Shirley stated her preference for Ward 28 in a firm voice to the volunteer supervisor and was duly sent off to the oncology department. She had made her only friend among the nursing staff on Ward 28. Some of the young nurses could be curt and patronizing to the volunteers, but Ruth Price, who had recently returned to nursing after a break of 16 years, had been charming from the first. They were both, as Shirley put it, Pagford women, which made a bond. Though, as it happened, Shirley was not Pagford born. She and her younger sister had grown up with their mother in a cramped and untidy flat in Yarville. Shirley's mother had drunk a lot. She had never divorced the girl's father, whom they did not see. Local men had all seemed to know Shirley's mother's name and smirked when they said it. But that was a long time ago, and Shirley took the view that the past disintegrated if you never mentioned it. She refused to remember. Shirley and Ruth greeted each other with delight, but it was a busy morning, and there was no time for anything but the most rudimentary exchange about Barry Fairbrother's sudden death. They agreed to meet for lunch at 12:30, and Shirley strode off to fetch the library trolley. She was in a wonderful mood. She could see the future as clearly as if it had already happened. Howard, Miles, and Aubrey Fawley were going to unite to cut the fields adrift forever, and this would be the occasion for a celebratory dinner at Sweet Love House. Shirley found the place dazzling. The enormous garden with its sundial, its topiary hedges and its ponds, the wide panelled hallway, the silver-framed photograph on the grand piano showing the owner sharing a joke with the Princess Royal. She detected no condescension whatsoever in the Fawleys' attitude towards her or her husband. But then there were so many distracting scents competing for her attention whenever she came within the Fawleys' orbit. She could just imagine the five of them sitting down to a private dinner in one of those delicious little side rooms. Howard sitting next to Julia, she on Aubrey's right hand, and Miles in between them. In Shirley's fantasy, Samantha was unavoidably detained elsewhere. Shirley and Ruth found each other by the yogurts at 12:30. The clattering hospital canteen was not yet as crowded as it would be by one, and the nurse and the volunteer found, without too much difficulty, a sticky, crumb-strewn table for two against the wall.
"How's Simon? How are the boys?"
asked Shirley, when Ruth had wiped down the table, and they had decanted the contents of their trays and sat facing each other, ready for chat.
"Si's fine, thanks, fine. Bringing home our new computer today. The boys can't wait, you can imagine."
This was quite untrue. Andrew and Paul both possessed cheap laptops. The PC sat in the corner of the tiny sitting room, and neither boy touched it, preferring to do nothing that took them within the vicinity of their father. Ruth
often spoke of her sons to Shirley as though they were much younger than they were, portable, tractable, easily amused. Perhaps she sought to make herself younger to emphasize the age difference between herself and Shirley, which stood at nearly 2 decades, to make them even more like mother and daughter. Ruth's mother had died 10 years previously. She missed having an older woman in her life, and Shirley's relationship with her own daughter was, she had hinted to Ruth, not all it could have been. Miles and I have always been very close. Patricia, though, she was always rather a difficult character. She's up in London now. Ruth longed to probe, but a quality that she and Shirley shared and admired in each other was a genteel reticence, a pride in presenting an unruffled surface to the world. Ruth laid her piqued curiosity aside, therefore, though not without a private hope that she would find out in due course what made Patricia so difficult. Shirley and Ruth's instant liking for each other had been rooted in their mutual recognition that the other was a woman like herself, a woman whose deepest pride lay in having captured and retained the affection of her husband. Like Freemasons, they shared a fundamental code, and were therefore secure in each other's company in a way that they were not with other women. Their complicity was still more enjoyable for being spiced by a sense of superiority, because each secretly pitied the other for her choice of husband. To Ruth, Howard was physically grotesque, and she was puzzled to understand how her friend, who retained a plump yet delicate prettiness, could ever have agreed to marry him. To Shirley, who could not remember ever setting eyes on Simon, who had never heard him mentioned in connection with the higher workings of Pagford, and who understood Ruth to lack even a rudimentary social life, Ruth's husband sounded a reclusive inadequate. "So I saw Miles and Samantha bringing Barry in," Ruth said, launching into the main subject without preamble. She had much less conversational finesse than Shirley, finding it difficult to disguise her greed for Pagford gossip, of which she was deprived, stuck high, on the hill above town, isolated by Simon's unsociability.
"Did they actually see it happen?"
"Oh, yes," said Shirley. "They were having dinner at the golf club, Sunday night, you know. The girls were back at school, and Sam prefers eating out. She's not much of a cook." Bit by bit, over their shared coffee breaks, Ruth had learned some of the inside story of Miles and Samantha's marriage. Shirley had told her how her son had been obliged to marry Samantha because Samantha had fallen pregnant with Lexi.
"They made the best of it," Shirley sighed, brightly brave. "Miles did the right thing. I wouldn't have had it any other way. The girls are lovely. It's a pity Miles didn't have a son. He would have been wonderful with a boy. But Sam didn't want a third."
Ruth treasured up every veiled criticism Shirley made of her daughter-in-law. She had taken an immediate dislike to Samantha years before, when she had accompanied 4-year-old Andrew to the nursery class at St. Thomas's and there met Samantha and her daughter Lexi. With her loud laugh and her boundless cleavage and a fine line in risque jokes for the schoolyard mothers, Samantha had struck Ruth as dangerously predatory. For years, Ruth had watched scornfully as Samantha stuck out her massive chest while talking to Vikram Jawanda at parents' evenings and steered Simon around the edge of classrooms to avoid having to talk to her. Shirley was still recounting the second-hand tale of Barry's final journey, giving all possible weight to Miles's quick thinking in calling the ambulance, to his support of Mary Fairbrother, to his insistence on remaining with her at the hospital until the walls arrived. Ruth listened attentively, though with a slight impatience. Shirley was much more entertaining when she was enumerating the inadequacies of Samantha than when extolling the virtues of Miles. What was more, Ruth was bursting with something thrilling that she wished to tell Shirley.
"So there's an empty seat on the parish council," Ruth said,
the moment that Shirley reached the point in the story where Miles and Samantha ceded the stage to Colin and Tessa Wall.
"We call it a casual vacancy," said Shirley kindly.
Ruth took a deep breath.
"Simon," she said, excited at the mere telling of it, "is thinking of standing."
Shirley smiled automatically, raised her eyebrows in polite surprise, and took a sip of tea to hide her face. Ruth was completely unaware that she'd said anything to discompose her friend. She'd assumed that Shirley would be delighted to think of their husbands sitting on the parish council together, and had a vague notion that Shirley might be helpful in bringing this about.
"He told me last night," Ruth went on, importantly. "He's been thinking about it for a while."
Certain other things that Simon had said, about the possibility of taking over bribes from Greys to keep them on as council contractors, Ruth had pushed out of her mind, as she pushed all of Simon's little dodges, his petty criminalities.
"I had no idea Simon was interested in getting involved in local government," said Shirley, her tone light and pleasant.
"Oh yes," said Ruth, who had had no idea either. "He's very keen."
"Has he been talking to Dr. Joanda?" asked Shirley, sipping her tea again. "Did she suggest standing to him?"
Ruth was thrown by this, and her genuine puzzlement showed.
"No, I... Simon hasn't been to the doctor in ages. I mean, he's very healthy."
Shirley smiled. If he was acting alone, without the support of the Joanda faction, then the threat posed by Simon was surely negligible. She even pitied Ruth, who was in for a nasty surprise. She, Shirley, who knew everybody who counted in Pagford, would have been hard-pressed to recognise Ruth's husband if he came into the delicatessen. Who on earth did poor Ruth think would vote for him? On the other hand, Shirley knew that there was one question that Howard and Aubrey would want her to ask as a matter of routine.
"Simon's always lived in Pagford, hasn't he?"
"No, he was born in the fields," said Ruth.
"Ah," said Shirley. She peeled back the foil lid of her yogurt, picked up her spoon, and took a thoughtful mouthful. The fact that Simon was likely to have a pro-Fields bias was, whatever his electoral prospects, worth knowing.
"Will it be on the website how you put your name forward?" Ruth asked, still hoping for a late gush of helpfulness and enthusiasm.
"Oh, yes," said Shirley, vaguely. "I expect so."
3. Andrew, Fats, and 27 others spent the last period on Wednesday afternoon in what Fats called spasmatics. This was the second from bottom math set taken by the department's most incompetent teacher, a blotchy-faced young woman, fresh from teacher training, who was incapable of keeping good order and who often seemed to be on the verge of tears. Fats, who had set himself on a course of determined underachievement over the previous year, had been demoted to spasmatics from the top set. Andrew, who had struggled with numbers all his life, lived in fear he would be relegated to the very bottom set, along with Crystal Whedon and her cousin, Dane Tully. Andrew and Fats sat at the back of the room together. Occasionally, when he'd tired of entertaining the class or whipping it into further disruption, Fats would show Andrew how to do a sum. The level of noise was deafening. Miss Harvey shouted over the top of them all, begging for quiet. Worksheets were defaced by obscenities. People got up constantly to visit each other's desks, scraping their chair legs across the floor. Small missiles flew across the room whenever Miss Harvey looked away. Sometimes Fats made excuses to walk up and down the room, imitating Cubby's bouncy up-and-down stiff-armed walk. Fats's humour was at its broadest here. In English, where he and Andrew were both in the top set, he did not bother to use Cubby for material. Sukhvinda Jawanda was sitting directly in front of Andrew. Long ago in primary school, Andrew, Fats, and the other boys had pulled Sukhvinda's long blue-black plait. It was the easiest thing to catch hold of when playing tag, and it had once presented an irresistible temptation when dangling, like now, down her back, hidden from the teacher. But Andrew no longer had any desire to tug it, nor to touch any part of Sukhvinda. She was one of the few girls over whom his eyes glided without the slightest interest. Since Fats had pointed it out, he'd noticed the soft, dark down on her upper lip. Sukhvinda's older sister, Jaswant, had a lithe, curvy figure, a tiny waist, and a face that, prior to the advent of Gaia, had seemed beautiful to Andrew, with its high cheekbones, smooth golden skin, and almond-shaped liquid brown eyes. Naturally, Jaswant had always been completely beyond his reach, 2 years older
and the cleverest girl in the sixth form, with an aura of being aware to the last hard-on of her own attractions. Sukhvinder was the only person in the room who was making absolutely no noise. With her back hunched and her head bent low over her work, she appeared to be cocooned in concentration. She had pulled the left sleeve of her jumper down so that it completely covered her hand, enclosing the cuff to make a woolly fist. Her total stillness was almost ostentatious.
"The great hermaphrodite sits quiet and still," murmured Fats, his eyes fixed on the back of Sukhvinder's head. "Mustachioed, yet large-mammaried, scientists remain baffled by the contradictions of the hairy man-woman."
Andrew sniggered, yet he was not entirely at his ease. He would have enjoyed himself more if he knew that Sukhvinder could not hear what Fats was saying. The last time that he'd been over at Fats's house, Fats had shown him the messages he was sending regularly to Sukhvinder's Facebook page. He had been scouring the internet for information and pictures about hirsutism and was sending a quotation or an image a day. It was sort of funny, but it made Andrew uncomfortable. Strictly speaking, Sukhvinder was not asking for it. She seemed a very easy target. Andrew liked it best when Fats directed his savage tongue towards figures of authority, the pretentious or the self-satisfied.
"Separated from its bearded bra-wearing herd," said Fats, "it sits lost in thought, wondering whether it would suit a goatee."
Andrew laughed, then felt guilty, but Fats lost interest and turned his attention to transforming every zero on his worksheet into a puckered anus. Andrew reverted to trying to guess where the decimal point should go, and contemplating the prospect of the school bus home and Gaia. It was always much more difficult to find a seat where he might keep her in his eyeline on the school-to-home trip, because she was frequently boxed in before he got there, or too far away. Their shared amusement in Monday morning's assembly had led nowhere. She'd not made eye contact with him on the bus either morning since, nor in any other way demonstrated that she knew he existed. In the 4 weeks of his infatuation, Andrew had never actually spoken to Gaia. He attempted to formulate opening lines while the din of spasmatics crashed around him. That was funny, Monday, in assembly.
"Sukhvinder, are you all right?"
Miss Harvey, who had bent down over Sukhvinder's work to mark it, was gawping into the girl's face. Andrew watched Sukhvinder nod and draw in her hands, obscuring her face, still hunched up over her work.
"Voila!"
stage whispered Kevin Cooper from two rows in front.
"Voila! Peanut!"
He was trying to draw their attention to what they already knew, that Sukhvinder, judging by the gentle quivering of her shoulders, was crying, and that Miss Harvey was making hopeless, harried attempts to find out what was wrong. The class, detecting a further lapse in their teacher's vigilance, raged louder than ever.
"Peanut! Voila!"
Andrew could never decide whether Kevin Cooper irritated intentionally or accidentally, but he had an infallible knack for grating on people. The nickname Peanut was a very old one, which had clung to Andrew in primary school. He had always hated it. Fats had forced the name out of fashion by never using it. Fats had always been the final arbiter in such matters. Cooper was even getting Fats's name wrong. Waller had enjoyed only a brief popularity last year.
"Peanut! Waller!" "Fuck off, Cooper, you glands-headed moron," said Fats, under his breath.
Cooper was hanging over the back of his seat, staring at Sukhvinder, who had curled over, her face almost touching the desk, while Miss Harvey crouched beside her, her hands fluttering comically, forbidden to touch her and unable to elicit any explanation for her distress. A few more people had noticed this unusual disturbance and were staring, but at the front of the room, several boys continued to rampage, oblivious to everything but their own amusement. One of them seized the wood-backed board rubber from Miss Harvey's vacated desk. He threw it. The rubber soared right across the room and crashed into the clock on the back wall, which plummeted to the ground and shattered. Shards of plastic and metal innards flew everywhere, and several girls, including Miss Harvey, shrieked in shock. The door of the classroom flew open and bounced with a bang off the wall. The class fell quiet. Cubby was standing there, flushed and furious.
What is going on in this room? What is all this noise?
Miss Harvey shot up like a jack-in-the-box beside Sukhvinder's desk, looking guilty and frightened.
Miss Harvey, your class is making an almighty racket. What's going on?
Miss Harvey seemed struck dumb. Kevin Cooper hung over the back of his chair, grinning, looking from Miss Harvey to Cubby to Fats and back again. Fats spoke.
Well, to be perfectly frank, Father, we've been running rings around this poor woman.
Laughter exploded. Miss Harvey's neck was disfigured by a rising maroon rash. Fats balanced himself nonchalantly on the rear legs of his chair, his face perfectly straight, looking at Cubby with challenging detachment.
That's enough, said Cubby. If I hear any more noise like that from this class, I'll put the whole lot of you in detention. Do you understand? All of you.
He shut the door on their laughter.
You heard the deputy headmaster, cried Miss Harvey, scurrying to the front of the room. Be quiet. I want quiet. You, Andrew, and you, Stuart, you can clear up that mess. Pick up all of those bits of clock.
They set up a routine cry of injustice at this, supported shrilly by a couple of the girls. The actual perpetrators of the destruction, of whom everyone knew Miss Harvey was afraid, sat smirking at their desks. As there were only 5 minutes remaining until the end of the school day, Andrew and Fats set about stringing out the clearing up until they would be able to abandon it unfinished, while Fats garnered further laughs by bouncing hither and thither, stiff-armed, doing the cubby walk. Sukhvinder wiped her eyes surreptitiously with her wool-covered hand and sank back into obscurity. When the bell rang, Miss Harvey made no attempt to control or contain the thunderous clamour or rush for the door. Andrew and Fats kicked various bits of clock under the cupboards at the back of the room and swung their school bags over their shoulders again.
Voila, voila,
called Kevin Cooper, hurrying to catch up with Andrew and Fats as they headed down the corridor.
Do you call Cubby Father at home? Seriously, do you?
He thought he had something on Fats. He thought he'd got him. You're a dickhead, Cooper, said Fats wearily, and Andrew laughed. 4. Dr. Jawanda's running about 15 minutes late, the receptionist told Tessa.
Oh, that's fine, said Tessa. I'm in no hurry.
It was early evening, and the waiting room windows made patches of clear royal blue against the walls. There were only two other people there, a misshapen, wheezing old woman wearing carpet slippers, and a young mother who was reading a magazine while her toddler rummaged in the toy box in the corner. Tessa took a battered old Heat magazine from the table in the middle, sat down and flicked through the pages, looking at the pictures. The delay gave her more time to think about what she was going to say to Parminder. They had spoken briefly on the telephone this morning. Tessa had been full of contrition that she'd not called at once to let Parminder know about Barry. Parminder said it was fine for Tessa not to be silly, that she was not upset at all. But Tessa, with her lengthy experience of the thin-skinned and fragile, could tell that Parminder, beneath her prickly carapace, was wounded. She had tried to explain that she'd been utterly exhausted the last couple of days, and that she'd had to deal with Mary, Colin, Fats, Crystal Whedon, that she had felt overwhelmed, lost, and incapable of thinking of more than the immediate problems that had been thrown at her. But Parminder had cut her off in the middle of her rambling excuses and said calmly that she would see her later at the surgery. Dr. Crawford emerged, white-haired and bear-like, from his room, gave Tessa a cheery wave and said, "Maisie Lawford?" The young mother had some difficulty in persuading her daughter to abandon the old toy telephone on wheels that the latter had found in the toy box. While being pulled gently by the hand after Dr. Crawford, the little girl gazed longingly over her shoulder at the telephone, whose secrets she would never now discover. When the door closed on them, Tessa realized that she was smiling fatuously and hastily rearranged her own features. She was going to become one of those awful old ladies who cooed indiscriminately over small children and frightened them.
She would have loved a chubby little blonde daughter to go with her skinny, dark boy. How awful it was, thought Tessa, remembering Fats the toddler. The way tiny ghosts of your living children haunted your heart. They could never know, and would hate it if they did, how their growing was a constant bereavement. Parminda's door opened. Tessa looked up.
Mrs. Whedon, said Parminda. Her eyes met Tessa's, and she gave a smile that was no smile at all, but a mere tightening of the mouth.
The little old lady in carpet slippers got up with difficulty and hobbled away around the partition wall after Parminda. Tessa heard Parminda's surgery door snap shut. She read the captions to a series of photographs showing a footballer's wife in all the different outfits she'd worn over the previous 5 days. Studying the young woman's long, thin legs, Tessa wondered how different her life would have been if she'd had legs like that. She could not help but suspect that it would have been almost entirely different. Tessa's legs were thick, shapeless and short. She would have hidden them perpetually in boots, only it was difficult to find many that would zip up over her calves. She remembered telling a sturdy little girl in guidance that looks did not matter, that personality was much more important. What rubbish we tell children, thought Tessa, turning the page of her magazine. An out-of-sight door opened with a bang. Someone was shouting in a cracked voice.
You're making me bloody worse. This isn't right. I come to you for help. It's your job. It's your...
Tessa and the receptionist locked eyes, and then turned towards the sound of the shouting. Tessa heard Parminda's voice, its Brummy accent still discernible after all these years in Pagford.
Mrs. Whedon, you're still smoking, which affects the dose I have to prescribe you. If you give up your cigarettes, smokers metabolise theophylline more quickly, so the cigarettes are not only worsening your emphysema, but actually affecting the ability of the drug to...
Don't you shout at me! I've had enough of you! I'll report you! You give me the wrong fucking pills! I want to see someone else! I want to see Dr. Crawford!
The old lady appeared around the wall, wobbling, wheezing, her face scarlet.
She'll be the death of me, that packy cow! Don't you go near her!
She shouted at Tessa.
She'll fucking kill you with her drugs, the packy bitch!
She tottered towards the exit, spindle-shanked, unsteady on her slippered feet, her breath rattling, swearing as loudly as her beleaguered lungs would permit. The door swung shut behind her. The receptionist exchanged another look with Tessa. They heard Parminda's surgery door close again. It was 5 minutes before Parminda reappeared. The receptionist stared ostentatiously at her screen.
Mrs. Wall, said Parminda, with another tight, non-smile.
What was that about? Tessa asked, when she'd taken a seat at the end of Parminda's desk.
Mrs. Whedon's new pills are upsetting her stomach, said Parminda calmly. So we're doing your bloods today, aren't we?
Yes, said Tessa, both intimidated and hurt by Parminda's cold, professional demeanour.
How are you doing, Minda?
Me, said Parminda. I'm fine, why?
Well, Barry.
I know what he meant to you and what you meant to him. Tears welled in Parminda's eyes, and she tried to blink them away, but too late, Tessa had seen them.
Minda, she said, laying her plump hand on Parminda's thin one.
But Parminda whipped it away as if Tessa had stung her. Then, betrayed by her own reflex, she began to cry in earnest, unable to hide in the tiny room, though she had turned her back as nearly as she could in her swivel chair.
I felt sick when I realized I hadn't phoned you, Tessa said, over Parminda's furious attempts to quell her own sobs. I wanted to curl up and die. I meant to call, she lied. But we hadn't slept. We spent almost the whole night at the hospital. Then we had to go straight out to work. Colin broke down at assembly when he announced it. Then he caused a bloody awful scene with Crystal Whedon in front of everyone. And then Stuart decided to play truant. And Mary's falling apart. But I'm so sorry, Minda. I should have called.
Ridiculous, said Parminda thickly. Her face hidden behind a tissue she'd pulled from her sleeve.
Mary, most important. You will have been one of the very first people Barry called, said Tessa, sadly. And, to her horror, she burst into tears too.
Minda, I'm so sorry, she sobbed. But I was having to deal with Colin and all the rest of them.
Don't be silly, said Parminda, gulping as she dabbed at her thin face. We're being silly. No, we're not. I'll let go for once, Parminda. But the doctor squared her thin shoulders, blew her nose, and sat up straight again.
Did Vikram tell you?
Asked Tessa timidly, tweaking a handful of tissues from the box on Parminda's desk.
No, said Parminda. Howard Mollison. In the deli. Oh, God, Minda, I'm so sorry. Don't be silly, it's fine.
Crying had made Parminda feel slightly better, friendlier towards Tessa, who was wiping her own plain, kind face. This was a relief, for now that Barry was gone, Tessa was Parminda's only real friend in Pagford. She always said, in Pagford, to herself, pretending that somewhere beyond the little town she had 100 loyal friends. She never quite admitted to herself that these consisted only of the memories of her gang of schoolmates back in Birmingham, from whom the tide of life had long since separated her, and the medical colleagues with whom she'd studied and trained, who still sent Christmas cards, but who never came to see her, and whom she never visited.
How's Colin?
Tessa moaned.
Oh, Minda. Oh, God. He says he's going to run for Barry's seat on the parish council.
The pronounced vertical furrow between Parminda's thick, dark brows deepened.
Can you imagine Colin running for election?
Tessa asked. Her sodden tissue was crumpled tightly in her fist.
Coping with the likes of Aubrey Fawley and Howard Mollison? Trying to fill Barry's shoes, telling himself he's got to win the battle for Barry, all the responsibility.
Colin copes with a lot of responsibility at work, said Parminda. Barely, said Tessa without thinking. She felt instantly disloyal and started to cry again. It was so strange. She'd entered the surgery thinking that she would offer comfort to Parminda, but instead here she was, pouring out her own troubles instead.
You know what Colin's like. He takes everything to heart so much. He takes everything so personally.
He copes very well, you know, all things considered, said Parminda.
Oh, I know he does,
said Tessa wearily. The fight seemed to go out of her.
I know.
Colin was almost the only person towards whom stern, self-contained Parminda showed ready compassion. In return, Colin would never hear a word against her. He was her dogged champion in Pagford. An excellent GP, he would snap at anyone who dared to criticise her in his hearing. Best I've ever had. Parminda did not have many defenders. She was unpopular with the Pagford old guard, having a reputation for being grudging with antibiotics and repeat prescriptions.
If Howard Mollison gets his way, there won't be an election at all, said Parminda.
What do you mean?
He sent round an email. It came in half an hour ago.
Parminda turned to her computer monitor, typed in a password, and brought up her inbox. She angled the monitor so that Tessa could read Howard's message. The first paragraph expressed regret at Barry's death. The next suggested that, in view of the fact that a year of Barry's term had already expired, co-opting a replacement might be preferable to going through the onerous process of a full election.
He's lined someone up already, said Parminda. He's trying to crowbar in some crony before anyone can stop him. I wouldn't be surprised if it was Miles.
Oh, surely not, said Tessa instantly. Miles was at the hospital with Barry. No, he was very upset by it.
You're so damn naive, Tessa, said Parminda. And Tessa was shocked by the savagery in her friend's voice.
You don't understand what Howard Morrison's like. He's a vile man, vile. You didn't hear him when he found out that Barry had written to the paper about the fields. You don't know what he's trying to do with the methadone clinic. You wait, you'll see.
Her hand was trembling so much that it took her a few attempts to close down Morrison's email.
You'll see, she repeated. All right, we'd better get on. Law needs to go in a minute. I'll check your blood pressure first.
Parminda was doing Tessa a favour, seeing her late like this after school. The practice nurse, who lived in Yarville, was going to drop off Tessa's blood sample to the hospital lab on her way home.
Feeling nervous and oddly vulnerable, Tessa rolled up the sleeve of the old green cardigan. The doctor wound the Velcro cuff around her upper arm. At close quarters, Parminda's strong resemblance to her second daughter was revealed. For their different builds, Parminda being wiry and Sukhvinda buxom, became indiscernible, and the similarity of their facial features emerged, the hawkish nose, the wide mouth with its full lower lip, and the large round dark eyes. The cuff tightened painfully around Tessa's flabby upper arm, while Parminda watched the gauge.
165/88, said Parminda, frowning.
That's high, Tessa, too high. Deft and skillful in all her movements, she stripped the wrapping from a sterile syringe, straightened out Tessa's pale, mole-strewn arm, and slid the needle into the crook.
I'm taking Stuart into Yarville tomorrow night, Tessa said, looking up at the ceiling, to get him a suit for the funeral. I can't stand the scene there'll be if he tries to go in jeans. Colin'll go berserk.
She was trying to divert her own thoughts from the dark, mysterious liquid flowing up into the little plastic tube. She was afraid that it would betray her, that she had not been as good as she should have been, that all the chocolate bars and muffins she had eaten would show up as traitorous glucose. Then she thought bitterly that it would be much easier to resist the chocolate if her life were less stressful. Given that she spent nearly all her time trying to help other people, it was hard to see muffins as so very naughty. As she watched Parminda labelling vials of her blood, she found herself hoping, though her husband and friend might think it heresy, that Howard Mollison would triumph and prevent an election happening at all.
5. Simon Price left the printworks on the stroke of 5 every day without fail. He'd put in his hours and that was that. Home was waiting, clean and cool, high on the hill, a world away from the perpetual clank and whir of the Yarville plant. To linger in the factory after clocking off time, though now a manager, Simon had never ceased to think in terms of his apprenticeship, would constitute a fatal admission that your home life was lacking, or worse, that you were trying to brown-nose senior management. Today, though, Simon needed to make a detour before going home. He met up with the gum-chewing forklift driver in the car park, and together they drove through the darkening streets, with the boy giving directions, into the fields, actually passing the house in which Simon had grown up. He'd not been past the place for years, his mother was dead, and he'd not seen his father since he was 14 and did not know where he was. It unsettled and depressed Simon to see his old home with one window boarded over and the grass ankle deep. His late mother had been house proud. The youth took Simon to park at the end of Foley Road, then got out, leaving Simon behind, and headed towards a house of particularly squalid appearance. From what Simon could see by the light of the nearest street lamp, it seemed to have a pile of filth heaped behind a downstairs window. It was only now that Simon asked himself how sensible it had been to come and pick up the stolen computer in his own car. These days, surely they would have CCTV on the estate to keep an eye on all the little thugs and hoodies. He glanced around, but he could not see any cameras. Nobody seemed to be looking at him except a fat woman who was openly staring out of one of the small, square, institutional-looking windows. Simon scowled at her, but she continued to watch him as she smoked her cigarette, so he screened his face with his hand, glaring through the windscreen. His passenger was already emerging from the house, straddling a little as he walked back towards the car, carrying the boxed computer. Behind him, in the doorway of the house he had left, Simon saw an adolescent girl with a small boy at her feet, who stepped out of sight as he watched, dragging the child with her. Simon turned the key in the ignition, revving the engine as the gum chewer came nearer. "Careful," said Simon, leaning across to unlock the passenger door. "Just put it down here." The boy set the box down on the still warm passenger seat. Simon had intended to open it and check that it was what he had paid for, but a growing sense of his own imprudence overrode the desire. He contented himself with giving the box a shove. It was too heavy to move easily. He wanted to get going.
"You're right if I leave you here," he called loudly to the boy, as if he was already speeding away from him in the car.
"Can you give us a lift up to the Cranach Hotel?"
"Sorry, mate, I'm going the other way," said Simon. "Cheers."
Simon accelerated. In his rear-view mirror, he saw the boy standing there, looking outraged.
saw his lips form the words, "Fuck you," but Simon didn't care. If he cleared out quickly, he might avoid his number plate being captured on one of those grainy black-and-white films they played back on the news. He reached the bypass 10 minutes later, but even after he had left Yarville behind, quitted the dual carriageway and driven up the hill towards the ruined abbey, he was ruffled and tense, and experienced none of the satisfaction that was usually his when he crested the peak in the evenings and caught the first glimpse of his own house. Far away across the hollow where Pagford lay, a tiny white handkerchief on the opposite hillside. Though she had been home barely 10 minutes, Ruth already had dinner on and was laying the table when Simon carried the computer inside. They kept early hours in Hilltop House, as was Simon's preference. Ruth's exclamations of excitement at the sight of the box irritated her husband. She did not understand what he'd been through. She never understood that there were risks involved in getting stuff cheap. For her part, Ruth sensed at once that Simon was in one of the tightly wound moods that often presaged an explosion, and coped the only way she knew how, by jabbering brightly about her day, in the hope that the mood would dissolve once he had food inside him, and as long as nothing else happens to irritate him. Promptly at 6 o'clock, by which time Simon had unboxed the computer and discovered that there was no instruction manual, the family sat down to eat. Andrew could tell that his mother was on edge, because she was making random conversation with a familiar, artificially cheery note in her voice. She seemed to think, despite years of contrary experience, that if she made the atmosphere polite enough, his father would not dare shatter it. Andrew helped himself to shepherd's pie, made by Ruth and defrosted on work nights, and avoided eye contact with Simon. He had more interesting things to think about than his parents. Gaia Borden had said hi to him when he'd come face to face with her outside the biology lab, said it automatically and casually, but had not looked at him once all lesson. Andrew wished he knew more about girls. He had never got to know one well enough to fathom how their minds worked. The yawning gap in his knowledge had not mattered much until Gaia had walked onto the school bus for the first time and provoked in him a laser-sharp interest focused on her as an individual, a quite different feeling to the wide and impersonal fascination that had been intensifying in him over several years, concerned with the sprouting of breasts and the appearance of bra straps through white school shirts, and his slightly squeamish interest in what menstruation actually entailed. Fats had girl cousins who sometimes came to visit. Once, going into the wall's bathroom right after the prettiest of them had used it, Andrew had found a transparent Lilette's wrapper lying beside the bathroom bin. This actual, physical evidence that a girl in his vicinity was having a period there and then was, to 13-year-old Andrew, akin to the sighting of a rare comet. He had had enough sense not to tell Fats what he had seen or found or how exciting a discovery it had been. Instead, he had picked up the wrapper between his fingernails, dropped it quickly into the bin, then washed his hands more vigorously than he had ever washed them in his life. Andrew spent a lot of time staring at Gaia's Facebook page on his laptop. It was almost more intimidating than she was in person. He spent hours poring over photographs of the people that she had left behind in the capital. She came from a different world. She had black friends, Asian friends, friends with names he could never have pronounced. There was a photograph of her in a swimsuit that was burned into his brain, and another of her leaning up against a filthily good-looking coffee-skinned boy. He had no spots and actual stubble. By a process of careful examination of all her messages, Andrew had concluded that this was an 18-year-old called Marco De Luca. Andrew stared at Marco's and Gaia's communications with the concentration of a code-breaker, unable to decide whether they indicated a continuing relationship or not. His Facebook browsing was often tinged with anxiety because Simon, whose understanding of how the internet worked was limited and who instinctively mistrusted it as the only area of his son's life where they were freer and more at ease than he, would sometimes erupt unexpectedly into their bedrooms to check what they were viewing. Simon claimed that he was making sure they were not running up huge bills, but Andrew knew it to be one more manifestation of his father's need to exert control, and the cursor hovered constantly over the box that would shut the page whenever he was perusing Gaia's details online. Ruth was still rattling from topic to topic in a fruitless attempt to make Simon produce more than surly monosyllables.
"Oh," she said suddenly, "I forgot. I spoke to Shirley today, Simon, about you maybe standing for the parish council."
The words hit Andrew like a punch.
"You're standing for the council?" he blurted.
Simon slowly raised his eyebrows. One of the muscles in his jaw was twitching.
"Is that a problem?"
he asked, in a voice that throbbed with aggression.
"No," lied Andrew.
"You've got to be fucking joking. You standing for election. Oh, fuck no."
"Sounds like you've got a problem with it," said Andrew, still staring into Andrew's eyes.
"No," said Andrew again, dropping his gaze to his shepherd's pie.
"What's wrong with me standing for the council?"
Simon continued. He was not about to let it go. He wanted to vent his tension in a cathartic outburst of rage.
"Nothing's wrong. I was surprised, that's all." "Should I have consulted you first?" said Simon.
"No."
"Oh, thank you," said Simon.
His lower jaw was protruding, as it often did when he was working up to losing control.
"Have you found a job yet, you skiving, sponging little shit?"
"No." Simon glared at Andrew, not eating, but holding a cooling forkful of shepherd's pie in mid-air. Andrew switched his attention back to his food, determined not to offer further provocation. The air pressure within the kitchen seemed to have increased. Paul's knife rattled against his plate.
"Shirley says,"
Ruth piped up again, her voice high-pitched, determined to pretend all was well until this became impossible,
"that it'll be on the council website, Simon, about how you put your name forward."
Simon did not respond. Her last, best attempt thwarted, Ruth fell silent too. She was afraid that she might know what was at the root of Simon's bad mood. Anxiety gnawed at her. She was a worrier. She always had been. She couldn't help it. She knew that it drove Simon mad when she begged him for reassurance. She must not say anything.
"Si?"
"What?"
"It's all right, isn't it? About the computer?"
She was a dreadful actress. She tried to make her voice casual and calm, but it was brittle and high-pitched. This was not the first time stolen goods had entered their home. Simon had found a way of fiddling the electricity meter too, and did small jobs on the side at the printworks for cash. All of it gave her little pains in the stomach, kept her awake at night. But Simon was contemptuous of people who did not dare take the shortcuts, and part of what she had loved about him from the beginning was that this rough and wild boy, who was contemptuous, rude and aggressive to nearly everyone, had taken the trouble to attract her, that he, who was so difficult to please, had selected her alone as worthy.
"What are you talking about?" Simon asked quietly. The full focus of his attention shifted from Andrew to Ruth, and was expressed by the same unblinking, venomous stare.
"Well, there won't be any trouble about it, will there?"
Simon was seized with a brutal urge to punish her for intuiting his own fears and for stoking them with her anxiety.
"Yeah, well, I wasn't going to say anything," he said, speaking slowly, giving himself time to make up a story. "But there was a bit of trouble when they were nicked, as it turns out."
Andrew and Paul paused in their eating and stared.
"Some security guard got beaten up. I didn't know anything about it, so it was too late. I only hope there's no comeback."
Ruth could barely breathe. She could not believe the evenness of his tone, the calmness with which he spoke of violent robbery. This explained his mood when he had come home. This explained everything.
"That's why it's essential nobody mentions we've got it," said Simon.
He subjected each of them to a fierce glare, to impress the dangers on them by sheer force of personality.
"We won't,"
Ruth breathed. Her rapid imagination was already showing her the police at the door, the computer examined, Simon arrested, wrongly accused of aggravated assault, jailed.
"Did you hear, Dad?"
she said to her sons, in a voice barely louder than a whisper.
"You mustn't tell anybody you've got a new computer."
"Should be all right," said Simon. "It should be fine.
as long as everyone keeps their traps shut. He turned his attention back to his shepherd's pie. Ruth's eyes flitted from Simon to her sons and back again. Paul was pushing food around his plate, silent, frightened. But Andrew had not believed a word his father said. "You're a lying fucking bastard. You just like scaring her." When the meal was finished, Simon got up and said,
"Well, let's see whether the bloody thing works at least. You," he pointed at Paul, "go and get it out of the box and put it carefully, carefully, on the stand. You," he pointed at Andrew, "you do computing, don't you? You can tell me what to do."
Simon led the way into the sitting room. Andrew knew that he was trying to catch them out, that he wanted them to mess up. Paul, who was small and nervous, might drop the computer, and he, Andrew, was sure to blunder. Behind them in the kitchen, Ruth was clattering around, clearing away the dinner things. She at least was out of the immediate line of fire. Andrew went to assist Paul as he lifted the hard drive.
"He can do it, he's not that much of a pussy," snapped Simon.
By a miracle, Paul, his arms trembling, set it down on the stand without mishap, then waited with his arms dangling limply at his sides, blocking Simon's access to the machine.
"Get out of my way, you stupid little prick," Simon shouted.
Paul scurried off to watch from behind the sofa. Simon picked up a lead at random and addressed Andrew.
"Where do I put this?"
"Up your arse, you bastard.
If you give it to me..."
"I'm asking you where I fucking put it," roared Simon. "You do computing, tell me where it goes."
Andrew leaned around the back of the computer. He instructed Simon wrong at first, but then, by chance, got the right socket. They had nearly finished by the time Ruth joined them in the sitting room. Andrew could tell from one fleeting look at her that she did not want the thing to work, that she wanted Simon to dump it somewhere and never mind the 80 quid. Simon sat down in front of the monitor. After several fruitless attempts, he realized that the cordless mouse had no batteries in it. Paul was then sent sprinting from the room to fetch some from the kitchen. When he held them out to his father on his return, Simon snatched them out of his hand as if Paul might try and whip them away. His tongue down between his lower teeth and his lip, so that his chin bulged out stupidly, Simon made an exaggerated, over-fiddling business of inserting the batteries. He always pulled this mad, brutish face as a warning that he was reaching the end of his tether, descending into the place where he could not be held accountable for his actions. Andrew imagined walking out and leaving his father to it, depriving him of the audience he preferred when working himself up. He could almost feel the mouse hitting him behind the ear as, in his imagination, he turned his back.
"Get fucking in."
Simon began to emit the low animal noise unique to him that matched his aggressively wadded face.
"Cunting thing! You fucking do it! You! You've got pissy little girl's fingers!"
Simon slammed the control and the batteries into Paul's chest. Paul's hands shook as he fitted the little metal tubes into place. He snapped the plastic cover shut and held the controls back out to his father.
"Thank you, Pauline."
Simon's chin was still jutting like a Neanderthal's. He habitually acted as though inanimate objects were conspiring to irritate him. Once again, he placed the mouse on the mat.
"Let it work."
A small white arrow appeared on screen and swooped cheerily around at Simon's command. A tourniquet of fear was released. Relief rushed through three of the watchers. Simon stopped pulling his Neanderthal face. Andrew visualized a line of Japanese men and women in white coats, the people who had assembled this flawless machine, all of them with delicate, dexterous fingers like Paul's. They were bowing to him, sweetly civilized and gentle. Silently, Andrew blessed them and their families. They would never know how much had hung on this particular machine working. Ruth, Andrew and Paul waited attentively while Simon put the computer through its paces. He brought up menus, had difficulty getting rid of them, clicked icons whose functions he did not understand, and was confused by the outcomes, but he had descended from the plateau of dangerous rage. Having blundered his way back to the desktop, he said, looking up at Ruth, "Seems all right, doesn't it?"
"It's great," she said at once, forcing a smile, as though the last half hour had not happened. He had bought the machine at Dixon's and connected it without the threat of violence.
"It's faster, Simon, much faster than the last one."
"He hasn't opened the internet yet, you silly woman."
"Yeah, I thought that too." He glared at his two sons. "This is brand new and expensive, so you two treat it with respect, you understand? And don't tell anyone we've got it," Simon added, and a gust of renewed malice chilled the room. "All right, do you understand me?" They nodded again. Paul's face was tight and pinched. Unseen by his father, he traced a figure of eight on the outside of his leg with his slender forefinger. "And one of you draw the bloody curtains. Why are they still open?"
"Because we've all been standing here watching you behave like a prick."
Andrew pulled the curtains shut and left the room. Even after he'd reached his bedroom and lain back down on his bed, Andrew was unable to resume his pleasurable meditations on the person of Gaia Borden. The prospect of his father standing for the council had loomed out of nowhere like some gigantic iceberg, casting its shadow over everything, even Gaia. For all of Andrew's life, Simon had been a contented prisoner of his own contempt for other people, making his house a fortress against the world where his will was law and where his mood constituted the family's daily weather. As he had grown older, Andrew had become aware that his family's almost total isolation was not typical and had become slightly embarrassed by it. Friends' parents would ask him where he lived, unable to place his family. They would ask casual questions about whether his mother or father intended to come to social events or fundraisers. Sometimes they remembered Ruth from the primary school years, when mothers mixed in the playground. She was much more sociable than Simon. Perhaps if she had not married such an antisocial man, she would have been more like Fats's mother, meeting friends for lunch or dinner, busily connected to the town. On the very rare occasions that Simon came face to face with a person whom he felt it worth courting, he adopted a salt-of-the-earth bluff persona that made Andrew cringe. Simon would talk over them, crack clumsy jokes, and often stepped unwittingly on all kinds of sensitivities, because he neither knew anything nor cared much about the people with whom he was forced to converse. Lately, Andrew had asked himself whether Simon even saw other humans as real. Why his father had been seized with the aspiration to perform on a wider stage, Andrew could not fathom, but calamity was surely inevitable. Andrew knew other parents, the sort who had sponsored cycle rides to raise money for the square's new Christmas lights, or ran the brownies, or set up book clubs. Simon did nothing that required collaboration, and had never evinced the smallest interest in anything that did not benefit him directly. Awful visions surged in Andrew's churning mind. Simon making a speech larded with the transparent lies that his wife swallowed whole. Simon pulling his Neanderthal face in an attempt to intimidate an opponent. Simon losing control and starting to spew all his favourite swear words into a microphone.
"Cunting, fucking, pissy, shit!"
Andrew pulled his laptop towards him, but pushed it away again almost at once. He made no move to touch the mobile on his desk. This magnitude of anxiety and shame could not be contained in an instant message or a text. He was alone with it, and even Fats would not understand. And he did not know what to do. Friday. 1. Barry Fairbrother's body had been moved to the undertaker's. The deep black cuts in the white scalp, like the grooves of skates on ice, were hidden by his forest of thick hair. Cold, waxen and empty, the body lay, redressed in Barry's anniversary dinner shirt and trousers, in a dimly lit viewing room where soft music played. Touches of discreet makeup had returned a lifelike glow to his skin. It was almost as though he slept, but not quite. Barry's two brothers, his widow and his four children, went to bid the body goodbye on the eve of the burial. Mary had been undecided, almost until the minute of departure, as to whether she should allow all of the children to see their father's remains.
Declan was a sensitive boy, prone to nightmares. It was while she was still in a fever pitch of indecision on Friday afternoon that there was an upset. Colin Cubby Wall had decided that he wanted to go and say goodbye to Barry's body too. Mary, usually compliant and agreeable, had found this excessive. Her voice had grown shrill on the telephone to Tessa, then she had begun to cry again, and said